You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of February 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24 live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, no sooner was France patting itself on the back for a job well done in Mali, the signs of a different strain of violence emerged today. We'll assess the impact of the country's first suicide bombing attack.
People have been predicting for some time that the various Islamist groups would begin to fight a kind of Al-Qaeda-style insurgency, and this looks like the beginning of that.
And as a number so large and fundamentally useless is found, you have to wonder why the search for the next prime number goes on. We'll speak to the mathematician who found the latest one. And as Carnival begins in Rio, we take a lesson in samba drums. I can't wait for that. All that plus some of Monocle's editors join us to run through this week's stories. And we'll play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. European Union leaders have agreed an historic budget deal at their summit in Brussels. The breakthrough was revealed by the President of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, who said the EU Commission had agreed on its multi-annual financial framework for the rest of the decade. He said it was worth waiting for. Reports say the agreement fixes a limit of 960 billion euros for projects the EU can promise to fund between 2014 and 2020, much less than the 1.03 trillion euros the Commission originally proposed. David Cameron, Britain's Prime Minister, said they'd cut the European Union's seven-year credit card limit for the first time ever.
As a result, the EU's seven-year budget will cost less than 1% of Europe's gross national income. Now, we had a lot of other objectives in these negotiations, which we've also been able to secure. We wanted a budget for growth, and this budget will enable the EU to do the things it should in a way that it can afford. It will encourage research and development, it will help the newest members to make up for the decades they lost under communism, and it will reduce the share of the budget taken by the Common Agricultural Policy.
But the leader of the European Parliament's Liberal group, Guy Verhofstadt, thinks the budget will be rejected by a parliamentary majority.
For the moment, I don't see a majority in the Parliament approving this, because it's an old-style budget with a deficit of more than 50 billion. Cuts have been made mainly in research, innovation, infrastructure, internet, and we don't see any new own resources in the proposal.
At least 33 people have been killed and about 100 injured in a spate of car bombings in mainly Shia areas of Iraq. Local officials say 17 people died in twin blasts at a market in Baghdad, and another 13 were killed in explosions in the town of Shomali, south of the capital. At least two people have been killed in a blast in the city of Karbala. Up to 50,000 Tunisians have attended the funeral of opposition leader Chokri Belaid. Mr. Belaid was killed on Wednesday by a gunman who fled on a motorcycle. There have been some clashes as his coffin was carried through Tunis, but the event was largely peaceful. Sporadic protests have been reported throughout Tunisia, and many workers are observing a general strike. Unions say the Islamist-led government is to blame for the killing, which it denies. Prime Minister Hamadi Jebali has tried to defuse tension by promising to form a non-partisan government. A suicide bomber has blown himself up in the northern Mali town of Gao, the first since French-led troops began their assault on Islamist militants. The attacker approached a group of soldiers on a motorbike before detonating an explosive belt, injuring one of the soldiers. An Al-Qaeda offshoot has claimed responsibility for the attack. Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani schoolgirl who was shot in the head by the Taliban, has been discharged from hospital in the British Midlands after making a good recovery following surgery. 15-year-old Malala was attacked in October after campaigning for girls' right to education. She had a titanium plate and cochlear implant fitted at Birmingham's Queen Elizabeth Hospital on Saturday. Italians are getting ready for elections, with final polls showing the centre-left Democratic Party are on course to win the February 24th, 25th vote. However, they'll need to form a coalition with the outgoing Premier Mario Monti. The polls show the party is still 5 or more points ahead, despite a scandal over a bank it's linked to, and former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's continuing resurgence. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill Bingham. It is 18.05 in London and 13.05 in Washington. We'll get the next news headlines in 25 minutes. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24, yokoso.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. A lone man today detonated a bomb belt he was wearing while approaching a military checkpoint in northern Mali, the first known attack of its kind in the country. The target, the French and allied military forces in Gao, went mostly unscathed by the suicide bombing, yet the implications of the event hint towards darker prospects for the future of Mali. Tristan McConnell, our correspondent who has been covering the Islamist rebel insurgency and the French military operation, joins us on the line now from Nairobi. First of all, Tristan, what is the latest you know about this suicide bomb attack?
Well, the suicide attacker approached a military checkpoint at one of the entrances to Gao earlier on today. He arrived on a motorbike and detonated, as you said, a sort of explosive belt. Now, it didn't actually have a great deal of impact in terms of casualties on the Malian and French side. In fact, he only managed to kill himself and I think injured one soldier. So it wasn't very effective in that respect. But what it does show is, I think, the beginning of the next phase of the war, if you like, which is we're going to see much more guerrilla fighting and these kind of more traditional al-Qaeda insurgent tactics, if you like. So suicide bombings like this, we'll probably begin to see improvised explosive devices. We've already seen some of that happening in northern Mali, and probably targeted assassinations too. So the significance of what happened today is bigger than the casualties. It's really about a new trend in this war in Mali.
Do you think this will affect the French involvement somehow already?
Well, I think it has to. I mean, France is actually being very level-headed about its involvement. There have been some mixed messages lately. We've been told, a few weeks back that they would stay as long as it took, and then we were told earlier this week that actually they'll begin pulling out in March. But they, when François Hollande visited Mali and Timbuktu at the weekend, he was very careful not to declare, victory, not to declare this is over. He said that we still have a long way to go. So I think France is very aware that, this is going to be a long battle. But what happened today just outside Gao, I think, will focus their minds on exactly what kind of a fight they're going to be involved in for the weeks, months, perhaps even years ahead. And that is a very hard to combat terrorist insurgency where the attacks can come from anywhere, frankly.
How much do we know now about the nature of the jihadists in Mali?
Well, I think another thing that became clear or was clarified by this suicide bombing is that, they're often described as being very opportunistic, very pragmatic, perhaps using jihad because it's, it's politically expedient. But this shows that there are, true extremists, if you like, people who are willing to martyr themselves in the cause of this war. And it also points to something that U.S. and regional security officials have been worried about for a year or more now, which is you know, the linkages between the jihadists in Mali and in the Sahara, so Al-Qaeda, Islamic Maghreb, and groups associated with them, and the groups we know perhaps better from Somalia, Al-Shabaab, and Nigeria, which is Boko Haram, where these sorts of attacks have been used frequently over the last few years. I mean, Somalia has seen a great deal of suicide bombings, roadside bombs, and so forth, and military officials have been very worried about the sort of strengthening ties between these groups. And this attack today, which is, as you said, the first one we know of in Mali really ever, suggests that there has been some sharing of technical know-how and so forth. And so I think we can expect the war in northern Mali to take on more of the characteristics of what we've been seeing in Somalia.
And another thing that happened today in Bamako was a new spat between two branches of the Malian armed forces. What is the latest on this?
Well, that's over with now. It lasted a few hours. Basically, one branch of the army went to try and push the group called the Red Berets, the paratroopers, try and move them from a barracks they were in. And then a firefight kicked off, and a handful of people were injured, maybe five or six, and I think one was killed. So it wasn't, again, you know, what it tells us about Mali is more important than perhaps exactly what happened, and that is that the Malian army is utterly incapable of defending its people and defending its territory. And that, again, will make France all the more aware, France and for that matter the African forces who are also coming in, that they cannot abandon Mali anytime soon to its own military because they are, frankly, incompetent.
So this war is nowhere to be over, nowhere close.
Certainly not, no. It's a long way from over. In fact, I think a new sort of phase in this war is only just beginning, and it's going to have a long way to run still.
Tristan McConnell in Nairobi, thank you very much for this. It is 11, almost 12 minutes past the top of the hour. Coming up, two of Monocle's senior editors join me in the studio to run through some of the stories we have been covering this week on Monocle 24.
Sichuan was one of China's poorest provinces until investment from Beijing and abroad brought boom time to its capital. Monocle's video journalist Gabriel Li paid a visit to Chengdu to gauge the progress.
Here the changes are radical. This has become a much more international city, and every day you see it growing more and more. This is the new market inside of China, which is, it's not a market itself, it's a continent. Foreign companies that want to sell something in China, now they're trying to come here. And you can see they're coming here.
Chengdu, the new China, in the films menu on Monocle.com.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and now that the week is almost at an end, it's time to take stock and reflect back on the stories we have been keeping an eye on these last few days. And I am happy to say that I'm joined now by Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, and
Hello.
Senior editor, Sophie Grove.
Hello
and welcome to the studio. So if we start from the most important news of this week, what are your picks?
Tunisia, without doubt. The assassination of Chokri Belaid, the opposition leader, has, I think, not only brought to a head a number of the issues that were bubbling underneath the surface in Tunisia. We've seen the fall of the sort of fall of the government, in that the ruling party has said they want to hold fresh elections, they want to bring in a new technocratic regime. But I think it's also brought attention to the fact that revolutions are complicated. They're complex. They don't take just 2 years. And although Tunisia had been seen in some ways as the poster child of the Arab uprisings, and still, if you want a poster child, they probably are it. This just underlines how difficult it is to go from a situation of a dictatorship to a fully fledged democracy. And it's going to take a generation for this to happen.
I think also it shows the strength of the Tunisian people. I mean, if you look at the scenes of the Chokri Belaid's funeral today, it's absolutely epic. I mean, the whole nation is on strike. He was a union man. And in some ways, he saw his own death. I mean, he actually said, you know, this is going to happen. I need unity. I need party unity. And then, you know, it did. But I think, you know, the fact that the whole country has come to a shuddering halt after this really shows, you know, why the Arab Spring started in Tunisia, even though it was such an unlikely place, kind of an unknown place and quite a small, sort of irrelevant place in the Middle East. There, it actually began. So I think it's interesting to see the reaction in Tunisia.
Two numbers which explain how important this is in Tunisia. 1.6 million people, that's the number of people that turned out for his funeral. 10.7 million, that's the population of the entire country. I mean, this is huge.
You already said that, you know, we've realised this week that, you know, revolutions don't just, you know, happen quickly, but it's a long-term process. Was there, did you actually, after having followed Tunisia for so long, did you actually expect this, something like this to happen?
I mean, I think it's funny, Tunisia is the one that a lot of analysts in the West have sort of not focused on quite so much because it's been slightly out of the headlines. Obviously, what happens in Egypt, what's happening in Syria, and to a certain extent, obviously last year in Libya as well, has certainly taken more of the space where these things are being talked about. But it's just one of those things, it's very easy to use the phrase Arab Spring and assume that these things can just happen quite quickly and naturally and smoothly. But they can't. I mean, it's, you know, as we've said before, when you look at the French Revolution, 1789, storming the Bastille, 1792, you know, Louis loses his head, Jacobin terror, 1795, Napoleon takes power, 1801. That's 12 years. And that's to go from a monarchy to a dictatorship.
You exactly.
Sod democracy, that's still decades away.
And so, I see you've memorised your dates and you have no notes. I just had to point that out to listeners at home.
I know my French Revolution. But it takes a while. These things take a long time. And I think we perhaps, you know, expect a bit too much.
Yeah, but it sounds like we can expect to talk about Tunisia a lot in the following months as well. What about the other news of this week? Has there been something that you think should have been reported more in the world's media? Something that hasn't got as much attention as it should have.
You're asking me or Sophie?
Both.
I was glancing at my notes this week. We've covered some really obscure stories here in Monocle 24, including smoking in mental institutions in Louisiana, which has been banned. But I actually think that there are some more sort of the nuances of negotiations that are going on. We've seen the organisation of Islamic Summit this week in Cairo. So Morsi met Ahmadinejad. They had met before, but there were some interesting pictures just of the two of them on the front pages, almost nuzzling. They were so... it was a funny embrace, but the way that it was caught. But just to see those dynamics going on. We've also seen a bit of a schism in the Syrian opposition, which I think has been analysed a bit in the press, but not really enough, because the head of the Syrian opposition, who's an interesting sort of intellectual sort of cleric character called Hatib, has said he wants to talk to Assad, which has surprised everyone and kind of shaken things up a bit.
There was one story that I thought that I was worried wasn't going to get enough attention, but I think fortunately through a couple of strange things has happened, it's been fine. And that was the hearings around the appointment of John Brennan as the new CIA director in the US. There'd been a lot of talk about Chuck Hagel, a lot of talk about John Kerry, but John Brennan is the guy that was responsible for the drones campaign, and he was also responsible for a lot of what the Bush administration liked to call enhanced interrogation techniques, you and I call torture. And I was worried that he was just going to sail through without any real look at his record. Fortunately, the time was quite good. This story about the secret drone base in Saudi Arabia came out just before his hearing. who knows why. And that meant that fortunately there was a bit more discussion about it. And I think he's not, yeah, he'll still be named CIA director, of course, but a lot more attention being put on a very controversial program, the drones program, which I know we're going to be talking about for pretty much the rest of the Obama administration.
It's definitely been an interesting week. Thank you very much for this, Steve and Sophie. You're listening to Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to me, Dori House, on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi. EU talks, particularly over budgets, are complicated, fraught and long. Very, very long. So long and so late that all the participants turn up with a change of clothes. It's like a sleepover, but less fun. The longer negotiations are even known as three-shirters. Last night appears to have been a three-shirter. The talks finally ended at 9 a.m. this morning, began again not soon after, and have finally been drawn to a close. The resulting deal, eked out of the small hours, is, according to European Council President Herman Van Rompuy, worth waiting for. How the politicians and press endure the marathon talks is something Quentin Peel is well qualified to elaborate on. He is the Financial Times Berlin bureau chief and is covering the summit, and he caught up with our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield before we came to air.
It is awfully complicated, and it's got an awful lot more complicated in the many years that I've been covering these things. I mean, it's because there are 27 countries and every single one has a domestic constituency they're trying to please while they get on with the negotiations. So whether it's Cameron or whether it's Hollande or whether it's Merkel, and all the small countries, I mean, right now, I think all the big countries are basically signed off on this deal. And it's now Austria, the Netherlands, there's the East Europeans, are all in there trying to sort of fine-tune what they can get out of it at the end.
But why is it that it's, I mean, why is it that we do this overnight and for so long? I mean, I've just heard Alexander Stubb, the Finnish Europe minister, saying he's starting to feel the sleep deprivation. Feels like I just hit a brick wall, would not mind a quick snooze. This does not sound like perfect sort of, you know, preparation for negotiations.
It isn't. I regret to say most international negotiations seem to be decided by sheer exhaustion. You just wear people down until finally they give in because they're too tired to defend themselves. And it was ever thus. I mean, I remember years ago in the negotiations for independence of half of colonies, my father, who was involved, saying, it's the person who can last longest without sleep who gets the best deal.
Wow. Is this really the way we should go, though? I mean, surely there is, you know, in particularly, let's take these talks. It's about setting a budget every 7 years. It's not as if we haven't had 7 years to work out the best way of trying to do these negotiations. Having talks which start after dinner and last through the night just seems a little bit ridiculous, doesn't it?
Well, I suppose it does, but at the end of the day, these are very, very deeply held national positions. I mean, just look from the British point of view at David Cameron's position. He's absolutely got himself into a hole. He promised flatly he was going to come back with cuts in the budget. But up against him would be not just the French, but the Italians, Spanish, the Poles, all determined to get what they can bring back for their constituents. And when you've got 27 different constituencies all fighting against each other, it's not like national politics. It's not just reconciling, let's say, the left and the right. It's reconciling the left and the right in 27 different countries. It is a nightmare. But that's what multinational negotiations are like. I don't think we're going to get away from it. It's dreadful to cover. I mean, we don't know half the time what's going on, and we just hear drips and drabs of the negotiations, and they're bloody complicated. All these figures are flying around, and half the time people have actually misunderstood, they've got a mistranslation, they don't know what's going on. So it's really very difficult for those people who follow it regularly to understand, let alone try and explain it to an outside world who wants to know what's happened to their taxes.
Well, how did you cover this last night? I mean, did you wait until they'd finished before getting a nap, or did you have a strategic little nap halfway through and hope that nothing important happened?
Well, I will tell you the absolute honesty. At 11 o'clock last night, I decided that this was going to go right through the night, and I went home and went to sleep telling my colleagues, send me a text message if they break. I got back here at 7 o'clock in the morning, just half an hour after Mr. Van Rompuy had tabled his compromise. I did very well.
That was Quentin Beale, Financial Times Berlin Bureau Chief, talking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, there. It's time for the news headlines in about 4 minutes. Before that, we have time for one song. This is Zwicka with Who You Are.
Getting ready for the night. Where the nights is...
That was Zwicka with Who You Are. In the next half hour of the program, we welcome a fundraising fashion label owning adventurer into the studio. And we also discover the latest and largest of prime numbers. And we also get a crash course in playing samba. But before that, here is Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
European Union leaders have agreed an historic budget deal at their summit in Brussels. Reports say the agreement fixes a limit of €960 billion for projects the EU can promise to fund between 2014 and 2020, much less than the €1.03 trillion the Commission originally proposed. At least 33 people have been killed and about 100 injured in a spate of car bombings in mainly Shia areas of Iraq. Local officials say 17 people died in twin blasts at a market in Baghdad, and another 13 were killed in explosions in the town of Shomali, south of the capital. At least 2 people have been killed in a blast in the city of Karbala. Up to 50,000 Tunisians have attended the funeral of opposition leader Chokri Belaid. Mr. Belaid was killed on Wednesday by a gunman who fled on a motorcycle. There have been some clashes as his coffin was carried through Tunis, but the event was largely peaceful. A suicide bomber has blown himself up in the northern Mali town of Gao, the first since French-led troops began their assault on Islamist militants. The attacker approached a group of soldiers on a motorbike before detonating an explosive belt, injuring one of them. Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani schoolgirl who was shot in the head by the Taliban, has been discharged from hospital in the British Midlands after making a good recovery following surgery. 15-year-old Malala was attacked in October after campaigning for girls' rights to education. Italians are getting ready for elections, with final polls showing the centre-left Democratic Party are on course to win the February 24th-25th vote. However, they'll need to form a coalition with the outgoing Premier Mario Monti. And those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi. A number 17 million digits long, divisible only by itself and the number one, and pretty much useless in a practical sense, has been discovered by a research department in the University of Missouri, America. It is, of course, a prime number and the largest one known to date. I won't give you the full title. Suffice to say, we'd be here till way beyond the end of this Midori House broadcast. But behold, here it is by its street name. 2 to the power of 57,885,161 minus 1. This latest discovery shattered the previous record holder of Amiga, 13 million digits, and is the product of a complicated investigative process of computer algorithms and mathematical minds, namely those of the University of Missouri, and spearheaded by one man who claims three of the latest prime number findings, Dr. Curtis Cooper. And he joins us now. Thank you so much for joining Midori House, Dr. Cooper.
Thank you for inviting me.
And congratulations for finding the longest prime number. How did you celebrate this discovery?
Actually, probably we haven't celebrated it yet, but I was pretty excited, but I haven't really done any formal celebration. I think we'll probably have a party at our university because it's been a team effort on our university's part.
To give our listeners some kind of an idea of what kind of work you do there at the university, could you tell me about your typical working day when you are looking for prime numbers?
Okay, sure. I have half-time release because I'm the editor of a magazine, a mathematical journal called the Fibonacci Quarterly, which is, I don't know if your listeners know what Fibonacci numbers are, but it's a quarterly magazine devoted to number theory and integer sequences like the Mersenne primes. And so I edit that. I teach typically 2 to 3 classes per day. And then as far as this project goes, probably two to three hours every day I try to manage our machines. We have about 1,000 of them on campus. And so I have a server and I kind of try to back up files whenever I can and start new machines running primes and things like that. So that's a typical day. Maybe in addition to my teaching and the editing of the magazine that I do, 2 to 3 hours are done with attending to this GIMS project.
When it comes to those few hours every day that you spend actually looking for prime numbers and working with that, how often do you get satisfaction from that work during the days when you don't find prime numbers?
Actually, I kind of get a lot of satisfaction in that. I just sort of anticipate it's like a process, like, okay, I need to go through this and I need to do this and our chances will be better of finding a prime if I can take care of this job today. Our previous one that we found was in 2006, and so it's been 7 long years, and, you know, maybe a month or two ago I was thinking, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? But then it's all worth it when this thing comes down. And I think, again, I get satisfaction with just the process, and I like it because it kind of marriages two things that I like, number theory and prime numbers and computers and how to use them and utilize them to solve a problem.
Dr. Cooper, I would ask you to describe the very moment when you discovered this number.
Okay. Actually, to tell you a little story, Friday night on January 25th at 5:30 was actually the time when our computer finished its calculation and it sent the report of the prime to the PrimeNet server in San Diego. And George Waltman, who manages this whole GIMS project, found out about 7 o'clock that it was prime. And so he sent an email out to about 10 of us. He sent one out to me, to Scott, and to some of the group that's going to double, triple, and quadruple check it. And that was at 7 o'clock that January 25th, that Friday evening. And I had been working on this Mersenne prime, doing my 2 or 3 hours of work a day, and I was pretty tired, and I went home to my wife, and I said, I'm pretty tired. I'm not going to do anything more. And so we woke up Saturday morning, we got ready to eat breakfast, and she got ready to go work out, and I looked at my email, and I had an email from George about, and I called her over, and I said, look at this. And I said, am I reading this right? And that was the moment I found out it was prime.
And what do we do with these numbers now?
In your intro, you were saying there's no practical application, and I'll verify that. Right now, there's no practical application. A part of it is we've climbed. I think a lot of mathematicians think we've climbed Mount Everest. This is kind of the equivalent of doing that in number theory, where there's a number out there, and we've discovered a new one that's, we didn't know existed until 2 weeks ago. And so that part of that beauty and part of that discovery is exciting. But I would say that there's maybe a couple of spin-offs that are applicable. This whole process of distributing computing over thousands of PCs around the world and working on a project and then collecting the data, if someone could, look at AIDS data virus and they needed a big army of computers to analyze that, this kind of a model could help to solve that problem. So that might be we've at least proved with our process that model would work. Another application was in the late 90s, the GIMS project was working at a smaller scale, of course, but they discovered running George's program that the Pentium chip had a flaw in it. And that flaw was discovered because of working on this project. So they had to make some design modifications and corrections. And then finally, 100 years ago, sort of the record primes were 100, 200, 300 digits long. And I think people back then would have said, you know, what good is a 100-digit, what good is a 200-digit prime? And today, we use those all the time in sending encrypted messages over the internet, securing your credit card information when you buy something online. And so, you know, I would say maybe we don't know what application this number has right now, but maybe in 100 years, somebody smarter than us might be able to figure that out.
Exactly. Dr. Curtis Cooper, thank you so much for coming on the show today, and congratulations once again. And on that numerical note, this is William Bell and Private Number. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 19 minutes to the top of the hour. We'll be back right after this with a special guest, both a successful entrepreneur in the fashion world, former soldier and fundraising adventurer. Where does Justin Packshaw find the time?
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time, or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. It's 18 minutes to the top of the hour. Trying to find some time for combining your work, private life, and maybe even some hobbies is a challenge for many. One could then assume that we can learn a lot from our next guest, who is not just a successful entrepreneur in the fashion world, but also a former soldier and fundraising adventurer. Justin Packshaw, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Markus. Lovely to be here.
It's great having you here. And, well, you've been travelling a lot around the world, many adventures, and now you're just back from South Pole. What kind of a trip was that?
Oh, my goodness. They're all amazing. This particular one was very poignant and special. I led a trip with a mate of mine, a very famous explorer called David Hempelman Adams, and we took three wounded soldiers to the South Pole on the 100th anniversary. And I used to be a soldier. And 100 years ago, when Scott and Amundsen were racing to the South Pole, that epic adventure, One of Scott's teams was a soldier called Lawrence Armstrong, Lawrence Oates, and he was the guy who did the most amazingly brave bit of self-sacrifice by walking out of his tent when he was slowing his teammate up and uttering the immortal words, "I'm just going out, maybe sometime." And what many people don't realise is he'd actually been wounded in the Boer War. So 100 years on, three soldiers from his regiment, all wounded in Afghanistan 3 years before, we retraced their steps in an expedition we called In the Footsteps of Legends. So it was brilliant. Most sort of importantly, we were raising money for two great charities, Alzheimer's and Walking with the Wounded. And thus far, I've raised 1.6 million. So it's really great and very proud to be involved with it.
That is a great amount of money. How do you get prepared for that kind of a trip, considering how cold it gets over there and how demanding that is for your physiques?
I thought you were about to say for how old you are, which is true. Me personally, I'm always sort of, I'm quite interested by being what the human can do. You know, the human body's meant to excel, and I don't think we really scratch the surface of our potential. So I always try and stay quite fit. This was an interesting one because obviously we were taking three very wounded soldiers. So we had to be very diligent and conscientious on how we prepared. We went to Norway and we trained in a fantastic place called Finse, which is very famous because, again, the old trips of yesteryear, they used to go there and train. So that was the first bit. You do the obvious thing. I'm sure people have seen mad people very early in the mornings dragging tires in parks. You have to do all of that. Obviously, these trips, polar exploration or any kind of polar trip, you are self-contained. So you have to drag your home with you. And so you've got to get used to dragging a big sledge behind you. So, yeah, that's how.
What do you learn from all that, you know, considering all the expeditions you've been on and you've been pushing yourself to the borders, being in really harsh conditions and all that? So, you know, what's been the lesson to learn for you and what could we learn from what you've gone through?
Well, it's a very good question. You learn an enormous amount of very poignant things. Extreme adventure, you have to strip out all the things that we take for granted. You don't have phones, TVs, all the distractions that you normally have, and you have to rely on yourself and operating within a team where you extract the best out of that team. So there's great sort of honesty and humility. You are incredibly careful about looking after everyone. So again, it's about watering and bringing out everyone's strengths and protecting their weaknesses. And those in those environments, these facts are really sort of brought to the forefront, and they're very, very encouraging. And it's strange that it's so difficult to do it in the real world because we're all moving so fast that you forget that actually if you look after people, they will operate and come to their best. And that's what we, you know, we try and do.
Is this something you're going to apply in business world?
I think so. I mean, I think if you look at a few years ago, I climbed Mount Everest, and if you look at what the skill sets that you need to put someone on the top of that mountain, but more importantly, to get them down, bear in mind, 1 in 12 people who do get to the top dies. There is a set of criteria, whether it's motivation, whether it's planning and preparation, your health and fitness, you know, all of those things will come together fundamentally under the umbrella of teamwork. And if you can get that right in the business environment, in my business, we're very conscious of this, and we really try to make sure that Monday is one, not a bad day, and that two people are happy in the environment that they work in. So, yeah, I think it makes a huge difference. And I think we can concentrate much more on it and learn things.
Have you got any more trips planned at the moment?
Very much so. My poor wife, she always dreads the next one. I am going to replicate an amazing rescue mission that, again, about 100 years ago, Ernest Shackleton did, again, from Antarctica. He took a small boat to from Elephant Island to South Georgia. I'd like to do that. And then personally, what I'd like to do is I'd like to go to the deepest part of the oceans.
Wow. I wish you good luck with those. Justin Backshaw, adventurer and entrepreneur, many thanks for coming in.
Thank you,
Mark,
very much. Great pleasure.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Mônaco 24.
Hongkong, Zürich, London. Das ist Monaco 24.
Hongkong,
Hongkong,
Zürich,
London,
London. Esto es Monaco 24.
Hongkong, Zürich, London. Tu vai Monaco, vada se ti cede.
From London,
London, London,
Canada.
This is Monaco 24.
In a moment, in honour of the start of Carnival, I'll be joined by the battery director of the London School of Samba, along with our illustrious Brazilian Fernando Augusto Pacheco to learn how to play the samba drum. But first here is Gal Costa and Balance. That was Gal Costa with Balance, a favourite from Fernando. Now, Carnival is upon us. Well, not really us, but parts of Brazil are enjoying it anyway. It's the main event of the year in the economic powerhouse. And there is even a saying in Brazil that the year only starts properly after Carnival. Cities like Rio and Salvador are already getting ready for the celebrations. But today the eyes will be on Sao Paulo, where the samba schools will parade on the iconic samba drama today and tomorrow. Each year the schools choose a different subject for their parades, with topics ranging from biblical stories to the history of sexual desires. For more on this and how we can learn a bit of samba, here is Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Fred Turuca, battery director of the London School of Samba. Welcome to Midori House.
Hello.
Fernando, first of all, how would you describe the importance of the carnival for Brazilians like you?
God, Marcos, it's the biggest event in Brazil. It's so important. And it's funny because even for people who hate carnival, they end up loving it because it's a holiday. So basically they can enjoy their time on a desert beach if they want.
And Fred, I heard you've been in Brazil already 4 times and you try to go there every 2 years. How did you get involved with the samba?
Strangely enough, it was at university that they had a samba bloco that was playing there. So I investigated, joined them, and through that bloco called Barking Bateria, I found the London School of Samba. And samba's pretty much been my life for the last 15 years.
You are from Tanzania originally. Do you find any similarities between samba and the music you get in Tanzania?
Strange enough, there are a few, not many, but I think the sense of community about sharing music and music being a tool to bring people together is definitely something that African flavour has translated as well in Brazil.
So when we are watching these parades, you see that basically all the samba schools come up with their own themes, and well, about Sao Paulo, do we already know what kind of themes we're going to be seeing there in a few hours when this parade begins?
We have quite a range of topics, Marcos. Just this year, just for you to have an idea, they're going to talk about fame, South Korea, Germany, and as I told you before, the history of sexual desire.
What can you expect?
Well, we can expect a lot of fun. And it's quite interesting, the German ones, I saw like some of the costumes, and it's going to talk about the German immigration in Brazil. And polemically, you know, the history of sexual desires, we have Adam and Eva.
Are they going to be wearing anything?
They will be wearing something. It's going to be tiny, but they will be wearing something, you know, because it's show live on TV, so we have to be careful.
Brazilian style. Well, Fred, when it comes to playing samba, it would be nice to get some kind of basic lessons from you. I can't try it myself now. I don't have yet my own drum, but you do. So, you know, if you want to start playing, what are the basic things?
Well, the aim with the samba is to get the swing, because there's a correlation between the dance and the drumming. So the samba swing, takaraka, 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 ta. So if played on a happy, it sounds like this. And it's about marking the beat. So it's like on the downbeat. So 1, 2, 3, you're hitting the skin of the drum and you're using your left hand to mark where the feet would change, the swing of the samba. So it'd be like this. And then you add an extra little flavour by giving it more stability. And that way, with the dance and the drumming correlating to both do that, it gives people the drive to kind of push forward as a school.
Even just that sounds amazing. Fernando, can you dance to that?
Oh God, I have to say, I'm feeling quite emotional, Fred. Well done. You're very good.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, I'm not a good dancer, Marcus, but I do enjoy samba.
I've seen you dancing sometimes. I think I've seen you dancing in the studio as well. You can dance.
Well, that's your opinion.
Well, Fernando, what do you wear and what do Brazilians normally wear when you go and see this parade? Or if you want to, well, of course, it depends on the theme, if you want to attend it.
Anything you want. I was Che Guevara a couple of years ago, but I mean, you can wear basically anything you want.
You were Che Guevara?
I was Santa Claus.
What would you wear, Marcus?
Do you have to match with a theme? Was there a Santa Claus theme? Was there a Che Guevara theme? Or did you just choose?
It depends. So, for example, there is the street carnival where everybody dresses like everything. So I was Santa Claus with Stranger Effort, white carrier bag masking as a beard and a Santa hat. I met an elf that was there, and there was various other kind of random costumes there. But within the actual parades, there are themes. So there's that the history of wine is one of the themes in Sao Paulo for a group called Vai Vai. So they'll have things to do with grapes, etc.
If I'm doing my maths right, the parade in Sao Paulo starts tonight in about 6 hours. What is the mood in Sao Paulo normally a few hours just before the parade begins?
I've seen a lot of my friends are posting on social media. They're talking about, everybody's talking about carnival, planning their trips. And the mood is very, I'm sure everybody's excited. Including me, even though I'm here in London, missing Brazil, but still excited.
Fred, could I ask you to play a bit more? You know, what's the next step after what you just played to us?
Basically, with this, it's depending on how fast the samba is. Obviously, with this, that is the basic swing. But as you develop, and obviously the speed of the samba in Brazil is a lot faster. It's more kind of... And so it's quite tempo-driven, so you've got to kind of match the idea of tempo with the same swing, and it's more bounce in your hand in order to progress your playing.
You know, I'm going to join your course.
You're more than welcome.
That's a deal. That was Fred Turuga, Battery Director of the London School of Samba, and of course we had Monaco's own Brazilian researcher in this studio as well, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thank you very much for both of you. That's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Anna John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Stick around for the menu next. This week I've been looking at food culture in Madrid, including a tour of the kitchens at the Royal Palace, where our correspondent Liam Olders will find out how to prepare for a dinner party fit for a king.
It takes from 5 to 7 hours. When you visit the Royal Palace, you see half of the table, but when it is ready for a state dinner, it is 45 meters long, and all around we can seat a maximum of 140 guests.
In 3 hours, it's time for this day's edition of the Monocle Daily. But now, from me, Marco Sippi, thank you very much for listening and have a good weekend.